on a hot summer's block where you sip your brew and never touch your glass. This is for eyes that cry like yours and learn to smile.
Bitfire breathes the lives of women of color in Montreal. We come together to say no to the silencing of our voices. Welcome to another edition of Spitfire Women of Color Radio, coming to you every last Wednesday of the month on CKUT 90.3 FM. We have a full house for you this evening, and we're pleased to welcome some new recruits, members of Spitfire. Welcome, ladies. We'll be introducing them more formally at the end of the show. Today, we've got playwright and Governor General Award winner Kevin Loreen's play, Where the Blood Mixes, which is being performed by Teasery Dunia Theater Company here. Nicole had the opportunity to attend one of the matinees and join in on a panel discussion that followed the performance. Nicole will be filling us in with a short review of the play, as well as discussing how art can be used as a form of healing. We will also be hearing excerpts read by Preeti Dhaliwal from her short novel Embodying Geography, an insight about her creative project. Shout outs to Preeti. She's a Spitfire from afar today, but she's with us. We miss you, girl.
Contributor to Spitfire Malek will be sharing a piece on the anniversary of the Sabra and Shatila massacre. Finally, Alyssa will look back at the Democratic National Convention and the appearance by former President Bill Clinton, who has been romanticized as this crusader for justice, women's right, and a man of the people. She challenges us to look at Clinton in both substance and policy, to come to a different conclusion. All this and coming up next on Spitfire Radio, Women of Color Radio.
La 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 la
laisse, mon lesbi et limier qu'elle n'y enquête. C'est chercher qu'à qui l'amour, moi t'es capable dans toute imagination, toute qualité, woman, tout genre. Moi j'ai essayé comprendre l'amour, fait tout ça pour moi, pas déconner déception, calculer sentiments de moi, vine décider que ça t'est l'amour, ça t'est seulement. Trouver en confortation, juste pour en moins content. Mais souvent, moi, t'es toujours, toujours tout seul, sans frapper ou ouvert pote en moi. Et où était bon, moi, tout près moi. Yeah, how, oh, how, gentillesse et reste, qu'elle m'y enquête. Est-ce que bon Dieu voyait? Chercher toute vie en moi, c'est ça. Geste dans l'esprit et limier qu'elle n'y enquête. Elle sourit et caché, car attendre tout ça tant pour m'énoncer. C'est resté qu'elle n'y enquête. Oh, oh, tout chercher, tout à chercher.
Welcome back to Spitfire on CKUT 90.3. I had the opportunity to attend a play called Where the Blood Mixes, which was produced and written by playwright Kevin Lorang, who's also was awarded a Governor General Award for this play. It is being produced currently by the Chisri Dunia Theatre, which has been around in Montreal, their local community theatre. They've been around for about 30 years, and the play was a multicultural cast, and Tisri Dunia means third world in Hindustan, and the goal of Tisri Dunia is to have plays that are social and political, and they deal with a lot of controversial contexts on their stages, and they also have a mandate to use multicultural mixed ethnic casts. So Kevin Lorang is from an interior Salish community in British Columbia. The name of the community is Mtsiklamish. The title of the play originates from his original community, Litton, which translates from the Salish language into place inside the heart where the blood mixes. So this play was a story about a family and a father and a daughter reconciling after 20 years. And the father is a residential school survivor, and the daughter has been taken away by social services after her mother commits suicide. So the story is really about dealing with continuing legacies and the legacies of trauma. It sounds heavy at first, but the play really did an excellent job of balancing between humor and then going into those very dark places of the heart. The play that I had the chance to see was also followed by a panel discussion on healing as an art form. or healing via different forms of art. And I think this was really, really important because human stories are necessary to break the silence and break taboos. And plays give us a chance to revisit issues that we see not only in First Nations communities, but in many multicultural communities throughout Canada. So this play revisited the loss of culture, mythology, ceremonies, and plays and art forms are necessary. And it can't be done in one generation at the same time. But there was something really special and unique about this play and its ability to allow the audience to enter into an experience that they may not have been ever had had an opportunity to understand. So myself, I'm not from a First Nations background, and I've heard a lot of people say, well, I have no ties to the Aboriginal communities in Canada. However, this play gave you the opportunity to actually experience with the audience and the cast members the suffering that they have felt, as well as the healing that came out through the play. And like I said, it was really heavy, but like, Kevin Lorang does not leave you in a place of darkness. Through his humor, he takes you out of that, and you know, there's tension between dark and light, but it still leaves you in a place and a place that's hopeful. And plays are more than just about theater. They're both about like life and death, pain and reconciliation, and I think these are necessary issues to revisit because we actually just cannot escape our ancestors. And I guess I'll just give a little information about people if they want to attend the play, because it is still airing, and it will be airing until the 30th of September, so you still have about 4 days left for you to attend it. The showings on the weekends are on the weekdays are 8 p.m. and Saturday and Sundays they have matinees at 2 p.m. It's playing at the Centre Culturel Calixa La Vallée, that's in Parc La Fontaine. Tickets are $24 for adults, $20 for seniors, and $12 for students. I strongly encourage anyone who enjoys an experience at the play or at the theater to attend this and see this cast. They did an excellent job. Lib Spry directed the piece, and if you go to the Sunday matinees, there will likely be a panel discussion following the play, which was really a good way to reconnect to all the emotions that we were experiencing while watching the play. And on that, I'm just going to leave you with a note of a quote, and that is, before the healing can take place, the poison has to be exposed. So I hope you find your way to where the blood mixes this week.
Thanks, Nicole. Okay, well, I was just going to try to play a Missing Justice plug that the station made. There's an awesome event going down. Is it this Friday?
Missing Justice Women and Women March? I think it's next Thursday.
Okay. And we'll just move on. This is Spitfire Women of Color Radio, Victoria Nam on the microphone. It is 6:14. And you are about to hear excerpts from Preeti Dhaliwal's latest creative project, Embodying Geography. This was a short novel that Preeti wrote during a 3-day writing competition that took place over the course of the Labor Day weekend. As some of our listeners may know, Preeti is a very multi-talented member of Spitfire. I'm really happy to have had the chance to interview her this past weekend. And yeah, I hope you enjoy our awesome interview and her reading of parts of her book.
Here with Katrina. I follow them off the train. The voluptuous one is carrying a picnic-sized cooler in her right hand. They must have gotten on in Edmonton. I bet they're gonna have a picnic. All of the passengers huddle down the same path, and I part ways with the women. I grab a watered-down coffee from inside the station and then wander out to sit at one of the picnic tables. There's only one left. As I pull my second leg in, I hear the small woman's nasal voice. Can we join you? I turn around. Yes, Hanji, yes, of course. I don't know why I respond partially in Punjabi when she spoke to me in English. Please do. Okay, so the story is actually about an older South Asian woman. So she's in her late 30s, nearing 40, and she's on a train coming from Toronto back to Vancouver. And it's basically about her journey home. I go through phases where I obsessively remove hair from my body, though I'm not particularly hairy. I forgot tweezers when I was backpacking through the Philippines with two friends of mine almost 20 years ago. I loved both men, but was in love with one and sleeping with the other. On one of my grumpy days, the one I was sleeping with bought me a drink. Halfway through the drink, I excused myself to use the bathroom. I was mortified when I saw the unshapely forest of thick black hairs growing above my eyes. It was far below my carefully fashioned curve. All I could see when I saw my reflection was the harvest that had cropped up in the 10 days I'd been traveling. I left the bar and the boys because there had to be a pair of tweezers in this market. It was a tourist market. Surely other tourists also desired tweezers? If not for their eyebrows, then for splinters in their fingers or whatever else white people use these things for. Three beads of sweat and 546 brisk steps later, I had not only bought a pair of tweezers, but passed back through the bathroom and returned to the bar with my preferred and socially acceptable face.
So, Preeti, can you elaborate a little bit more about the character that we are experiencing through this first-person narrative, how it develops over time, and perhaps how it explores questions of identity and difference?
That's a great question, Victoria. So Mindy is a South Asian woman who has lived in Canada. She was born here her whole life. And a lot of what the book is exploring is the conflicts that she experiences in her life and has experienced in her life being a South Asian woman in Canada. What are the cultural conflicts that come up? When does she realize, and when is she made aware of the fact that she is South Asian and a woman? And so it really looks at those particular experiences or stories in her life that have highlighted those for her, that she is different than other people around her. What I wanted to do was to write something that maybe other South Asian women would connect to. Maybe they don't have similar experiences. Mindy certainly is not all South Asian women. She is one. But I think in making it real and writing it on a page, other women, maybe they're South Asian, maybe they're not, can read it and see if they've ever had similar feelings. And it's kind of that sense that you're not alone in having certain thoughts. Mm-hmm. I'm less picky about the hair on my legs and in my armpits these days. My armpit hair is obvious. And women actually notice it more than men. I almost like seeing how it makes them uncomfortable and revel in their attempts not to stare. Their extended sense of shame pleases me for some reason.
I guess my question, after having heard what you just read, is the relationship between the character and maybe your own experiences.
Mm-hmm. I think it's somewhere in between. Certainly the novel has a lot of fictional things in it, but at some level, their feelings or thoughts that I've either had or that I've heard other women have. So something that someone has shared with me that I can identify with or understand to some extent. And sometimes it's something that might be a little intellectual and abstract. I mean, when we listen to this excerpt, it is, for me, it's the idea that what we are shown is beautiful growing up here is usually white women in magazines, and the typical version of beauty is often around what that looks like, and there are less examples of what does a beautiful South Asian woman look like, and how are we different? Our bodies are shaped a little different, and is that beautiful, and do I see that represented around? And then what impact does that have on how I feel on a daily basis or how I see others perceiving me? And it may be completely inaccurate. I mean, Mindy's thoughts aren't the truth. They're just a particular individual's feelings as to how others are receiving her a lot of the time and her responses to that. What? I asked, my head resting in the palm of my right hand. The silence and the fear of what he saw was becoming too much for me. You're really cute, he said with a childish grin. His typical childish grin. When I'm around South Asian men, I trust that I'm beautiful. Around white men, I never believe that I'm beautiful enough. For some reason, I find comfort in being with a South Asian man. I don't feel I have to be perfect or beautiful all the time. There's a sense of acceptance that I just can't achieve with a white man, no matter how hard I try. Our disparities are just too great. My perception of their vision of beauty is too disparate.
And what is it like to, you know, do such a character-driven first-person narrative piece? You wrote it in 3 days. You must have been really in a certain kind of zone of thinking. Like, what was that like? How did you, you know, work through the creative process?
Mm-hmm. Definitely writing in 72 hours. It was very stream of consciousness. Whatever came out, my goal was to write 100 pages. So it was an interesting process to dive really deep inside of myself or what... It was deep inside of myself. That is true. Especially after having done legal work over the summer, which is very abstract and detached. And I hadn't been writing for most of the summer, and I hadn't even been reading many novels over the summer, so I didn't have an example or a sample that I had just come out of that I would try to mimic or might have been in the back of my head. It was very fresh and raw, and at times a little difficult, but for the most part, I think I always find writing very liberating, that maybe these were thoughts that I had at some point, or that I felt when I got into this character she would have. And why not write about them? Why not have people read them? And you know, some of these things would really piss people off. And they'd think it's completely inaccurate and it doesn't represent them. And I'm not saying it does, but it's just, it feels good to let it out rather than keeping it in.
Mm, for sure, definitely.
My back can never be touched enough. When I'm in bed with a man, I give full attention to his back. I massage it with one hand, trace pictures on or run my nails down it until I fall asleep. He usually falls asleep without having given me similar attention. He feels okay with taking, and I feel obligated to give, even when I don't particularly want to.
So just also to return to what you were telling me about earlier, that this story and this novel is an exploration for finding home. And returning home, and whether or not home is there when she gets there. Obviously, this is embedded in issues of being a person of color and trying to find home here in Canada.
Absolutely, and I think actually in the second chapter that a lot of this comes up. She questions how Vancouver is home. And that it is unceded Coast Salish territory. And she has flashbacks to the first time she went to India and what that felt like being on that land, which is where her parents grew up. So she is first generation. Her parents were raised in India and she was born in Vancouver. And so she's going through the political problems, basically, or not problems, but issues of calling Canada home, and then the personal and cultural ones as well. And I don't think she comes to a conclusion necessarily. I think she decides on a place to stay, but I think the question of home, even at the end of the novel, is still open.
Hmm.
I mean, I think what it is being a member of any diaspora, there's always going to be an issue of what is home, because there's a territory that we are from, in quotation marks, where our parents grew up, and we have a long ancestry there. And even when in this book, this character goes there and there's a feeling that she has when she touches the dirt in that village of her ancestors whispering to her, you're home. And
what is that? Is it something psychological that she's constructed, or is it something really real that, you know, her ancestors' bones and ashes lie in that area, and there is something more spiritual that connects her to that land? But then she also goes back to Vancouver, and she feels a strong connection to mountains and different things there, and her family and friends that are there. So the exploration is, where does she belong? And where is she going to call home? And I think, even though it's still an open question, it's something that she wants to find within herself, so that wherever she goes, she will be home, that she will create that.
I'm going to teach you to find home in you so that it's with you no matter where you are. This woman claims she could teach refugee and immigrant youth, people who were displaced in some way, to find home in their bodies. I still want to know how, and regret that I never asked her to tell me, because I'm looking for a place to call home. I sometimes think I've found home in this body, but then I seek it in other places. The body of another, or a place I once was, it's always transient, always fleeting.
So thank you so much for joining us today and sharing this amazing project with the audience here at Spitfire Women of Color Radio. Just some last thoughts about the process of writing a short novel in the circumstances in which you did. Why did you feel compelled to do it? Well, you were saying that having done a lot of legal work, it was a great creative flight. But maybe you can elaborate on what you gained from the experience, any kind of surprises that you had throughout the process, and would you do it again?
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you for having me. This has been an amazing experience just to talk about it with you. And I guess what the process has done for me is taken me back to a creative space that I really needed. I think I've always written since I was seven, eight years old. I still have my journals, and sometimes I go through phases, particularly this past summer, where I was so mentally exhausted after work that I didn't take the time to do that writing. And going back into this process was amazing, first because of the support I received from people in my life that knew I was doing it, and even from interviews like this, and realizing that sharing the words is helpful to others in terms of, maybe not helpful, but interesting for others to read. And the support that I received from family, just setting me up for those 72 hours and kind of, you know, bringing me meals, and another friend who's a writer, asking him for some words of inspiration when I got to a blocked place. And that was really exciting to see that I could receive support for my creative endeavors, because I think a lot of us who sometimes enter the workforce leave that creativity behind and start thinking that these are dreams that kids have, you know? Some of us might want to be painters. Some of us might want to be writers. Some of us might want to be dancers. And we let go of those things and let our work consume us to some level. And I think, and the reason I do this is because I don't want to let that happen 100%. And it might happen during certain periods of the year. But I always want this 3 days, these 72 hours, to remember that this is something that I need. And this is something that I love. And maybe it's, I mean, I don't know where it will go necessarily, but it gets me started on a project and lets me voice something that I need to let out of myself. So what this might become, it might become a series of short stories. I might grab a couple of poems out of some of the chapters, or maybe I'll finish it and it'll end up being a novel at some point. But it at least gives me hope that I still have a commitment to my creativity.
Brown men somehow represent home, even though I barely know where it is myself. They understand a culture I was raised in, and they'll fit into my family. All these things tell me that something about them is right. The beat of a tabla resonates in their heart the same way it does in mine. The lyrics to a Hindi song sits in their soul the same way it does in mine. The language they first learned to feel in is the same as mine. This creates a closeness that can't be replicated in any other form. All of these things must mean something. This causes me to imagine a future with men who don't see or love me the way I need to be seen and loved, but who are able to register the sounds and symbols of my childhood. This isn't all Punjabi South Asian men, and I am not all Punjabi South Asian women. This is just a few of them and one of me.
I don't pretend they're perfect. I mean, I can barely learn to trust them, but for some reason, I'm ready to accept their flaws when I meet them.
ਜਦੋਂ ਲੱਗਿਆ ਵੀਰਾ ਤੈਨੂੰ ਮਾਇਆ ਵੇ ਜਦੋਂ ਲੱਗਿਆ ਵੀਰਾ ਤੈਨੂੰ ਮਾਇਆ ਵੇ ਤੇਰੀ ਮਾਂ ਨੂੰ ਮਿਲਣ ਵਧਾਈਆਂ ਵੇ ਲਟਕੇ ਦੇ ਵਾਲ ਸੁਨੇ ਸੁਣਿਆ ਵੀਰਾ ਮੈਂ ਤੈਨੂੰ ਓੜੀ ਜਦੋਂ ਚੜਿਆ ਵੀਰਾ ਘੋੜੀ ਵੇ ਜਦੋਂ ਚੜਿਆ ਵੀਰਾ ਘੋੜੀ ਵੇ ਤੇਰੇ ਨਾਲ ਭਰਾਵਾਂ ਦੀ ਜੋੜੀ
Missing Justice and the 2110 Center for Gender Advocacy vous invite à participer et à apporter votre soutien au 7e édition du annual Sisters in Spirit Memorial March and Vigil Thursday, October 4th at 6 p.m. at Parc Emily Gamelin, corner of Barrie and St. Catherine, Metro Barrie. Approximately 600 Native women have gone missing or been murdered since roughly 1980, according to the Native Women's Association of Canada. Other organizations and activists suspect that the actual number is as high as 3,000. On October 4th, we will honor the memories of these missing and murdered women and girls, raise awareness about this issue, and demand that the government support the actions of families and communities. Jeudi le 4 octobre, 6 p.m. au Parc Emily Gamelin, coin du Berry et Sainte-Catherine, Metro Berry. CKUT will be live broadcasting from the march. Join us or tune in to 90.3 FM. This is a CKUT co-presentation.
This September 30th marks the 30-year anniversary of the infamous Sabra and Shatila massacre, in which hundreds, possibly thousands, of defenseless Palestinian refugees were slaughtered by Lebanese right-wing militias under the cover of the Israeli military. The United Nations General Assembly has since declared the massacre to be an act of genocide, though arguably it is one of the least known genocides in Western memory, despite its harrowing stature in the Arab world. Israel's involvement in the Lebanese civil war began in June 1982 when it invaded its northern neighbor. Its goal was to root out the Palestinian Liberation Organization and transform Lebanon into a Christian-ruled ally. The Israel Defense Forces soon besieged PLO-controlled areas in the western part of Beirut. Intense Israeli bombardments led to heavy civilian casualties. The United States agreed to deploy Marines to Lebanon as part of a multinational force to supervise the PLO's departure. And by September 1st, thousands of its fighters, including Yasser Arafat, had left Beirut for various Arab countries. After America negotiated a ceasefire that included written guarantees to protect the Palestinian civilians remaining in the camp from vengeful Lebanese Christians, the Marines departed Beirut on September 10, 1982. Israel hoped that Lebanon's new elected president, Bashir Gemayel, a Maronite, would support an Israeli-Christian alliance. But 4 days later, on September 14th, Gemayel was assassinated. Israel reacted by violating the ceasefire agreement. It quickly occupied West Beirut, ostensibly to prevent militia attacks against the Palestinian civilians. "The main order of the day is to keep peace," Begin told the American envoy to the Middle East on September 15th. "Otherwise, there could be pogroms." On September 16th, the IDF was fully in control of West Beirut, including Sabra and Shatila. Defense Minister Sharon said the occupation in West Beirut was justified because there were, quote, 2,000 to 3,000 terrorists who remained there, a claim widely accepted as pure war propaganda in the wake of the September 1st withdrawal. On the evening of September 16th, the Israeli cabinet met and was informed that pro-Gemayel fighters were entering the Palestinian camps. That evening, word of civilian deaths began to filter out to Israeli military officials, politicians, and journalists. By noon the next day, Foreign Minister Shamir hosted a meeting with top U.S. officials who tried to mediate an Israeli withdrawal from Lebanon. No word of the slaughter in the camps was mentioned. The transcript of the September 17, 1982 meeting reveals how Israel's refusal to relinquish areas under its control and its delays in coordinating with the Lebanese National Army, whom the Americans had expected to step in, prolonged the slaughter. Defense Minister Sharon, present at the meeting, was well aware of the carnage that had begun in the West Beirut camps. Among his statements that day, I just don't understand what you're looking for. Do you want the terrorists to stay? Are you afraid that somebody will think that you were in collusion with us? Deny it. We denied it. Nothing will happen. Maybe some more terrorists will be killed. That will be for the benefit of all of us. So we'll kill them. There will not be any left there. You're not going to save them. You're not going to save these groups of international terrorists. If you don't want the Lebanese to kill him, we'll kill him. Despite these reprehensible misrepresentations, we now know that nearly all the dead at Sabra and Shatila were women, children, and the elderly. In short, defenseless Palestinian refugees. One such man, a Palestinian survivor who was a young boy when he witnessed the killings, tells his story. Sabra was bustling with life, even after 3 full months of death and destruction brought about by the Israeli siege of Beirut. So was the Shatila camp. People had returned to their homes with a false sense of security. Everyone, including my 13-year-old self, was deceived into thinking that the war was over. Then came news of the killing of President Gamal that shook us out of this delusion. A neighbor went out on his balcony and shot a hail of bullets into the sky to celebrate. My feelings were a mixture of outrage and panic. I was repulsed by those who did not respect the sanctity of death and was simultaneously worried that the assassination would usher in a new season of deaths. The next day, Israeli warplanes clouded the Beirut skies again, flying lower than I had ever seen them before. They flew low enough for me to easily see the Star of David on their hulls. My room had a southern view facing Shatila. I could not make out what was happening, but I could clearly hear the sounds of heavy military vehicles and the lights from flares. One night, my father's colleague arrived from the camp, which is how residents referred to Shatila. We never heard Sabra being called a camp until after the slaughter. Someone asked him in a loud voice to tell them exactly how he managed to cross over all the dead bodies in Shatila. The rumors kept multiplying, and the news on the radio confirmed the gravity of the situation to all who refused to believe. Then came the stories of blood and corpses and kidnapping. Some people spoke about passing through Sabra over rivers of blood. They were not exaggerating. Another survivor explains, "We couldn't believe that people were using knives on others," she said in an interview with Al Arabiya English. Describing some of the horrific scenes, she said, "I saw an old lady. Her mouth slit from ear to ear because she was singing to Abu Amr, Yasser Arafat. I saw the body of a child less than a month old, plastered on the side of an armored vehicle." Anguish rising in her voice, she recalled the bodies lying on the ground, riddled with bullet holes and slashed with machetes. From his cinder block home in a Shatila refugee camp, Yusuf Hamza remembers peering through a bathroom vent when he heard a woman running down the alley screaming his name. Her arm was gushing blood, but Hamza remained silent. Moments later, the militia men came trampling after her, and he knew he had to act fast. He motioned quietly to his family, who were crouching in the dark, to get ready to make a run for it. "I told them, don't speak. Don't cough," the 65-year-old Palestinian refugee recalls, scratching a thin white beard. "Either we are going to be killed here or die trying to escape." He told those who protested, "We will rely on God." That night, while Hamza kept his family frantically on the move in the dark streets, others seeking shelter underground were less safe. Hamid Shamis was hiding in a basement with his brother and father when the soldiers marched them out. Hamas was only 17 when he was stuck in the back with a rifle butt after he refused to line up outside with the others. He was shoved into place against the concrete wall and the militiamen opened fire. 30 years later, Shamas unfurls a tattered sepia print that captured the aftermath, a heap of bodies with their arms and legs outstretched, one of the most iconic images of the Sabra and Shatila massacre. He points to the limbs of his father and 22-year-old brother among the dead. Shamis himself was shot twice. One bullet grazed his head and another entered his leg. He was shielded from additional rounds when the bodies of others collapsed on top of him. "I hid under the bodies for 2 days," he says. The Shatila killing spree went on for 48 hours and left piles of dead bodies rotting in the September sun. Photographs taken just after the attack show mutilated adult corpses with newborn babies tossed among them. Many were buried in a mass grave at the edge of the Shatila camp, now marked by a single tombstone on an unkempt red dirt lot. Survivors say women were routinely raped and some victims were buried alive or shot in front of their families. Truckloads of others were hauled away, never to be heard from again. Are these the pogroms of which Israeli Prime Minister Begin was so concerned? War journalist Robert Fisk recalls visiting the camps in the wake of the massacre. We were so overwhelmed by what we found in Shatila that at first we were unable to register our own shock. Bill Foley of the Associated Press came with us. All he could say as he walked around was Jesus Christ over and over again. We might have accepted evidence of a few murders, even dozens of bodies killed in the heat of combat. But there were women lying in their houses with their skirts torn up around their waists and their legs wide apart, children with their throats cut, rows of young men shot in the back after being lined up at an execution wall. There were babies, blackened babies, because they had been slaughtered no more than 24 hours earlier, and their small bodies were already in a state of decomposition, tossed into rubbish heaps alongside discarded U.S. Army rations, Israeli Army equipment, and empty bottles of whiskey. The Israeli government-sponsored Khan Commission estimated that the death toll was at about 800, but other researchers, including Israeli author Anan Kablak, said the number was closer to 3,500. These massive numbers go so far beyond even what the Israelis would have in other circumstances called terrorist activity. It was a war crime. Years later, Mr. Draper, the then American envoy to the Middle East, called the massacre obscene. In an oral history recorded a few years before his death in 2005, he remembered telling Mr. Sharon, "You should be ashamed. The situation is absolutely appalling. They're killing children. You have the field completely under your control and are therefore responsible for that area." But the belated expression of shock and dismay belies the Americans' failed diplomatic effort during the massacre. In the wake of Sabra and Shatila, America now stands at another precipice under the specter of war with Iran. It's incredible to think of it, just how much the situation then is eerily relevant to the current virulent demands of Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu that the U.S. support a military strike against Iran's nuclear facilities. The immense fear propagated by the Israeli government and its use of deceptive tactics is nothing new, nor is American kowtowing to Israeli demands. And all in a world where the only country to ever have actually used the nuclear bomb is the very one which now seeks to stand in moral judgment of its international counterparts. When exactly was it, I wonder, that we took Nagasaki from Never Again and Hiro from Hiroshima? Back to 1982. In the aftermath of the massacre, the United States felt compelled by guilt to redeploy the Marines, who ended up without a clear mission in the midst of a brutal civil war. On October 23, 1983, the Marine barracks in Beirut were bombed and 241 Marines were killed. The attack led to open warfare with Syrian-backed forces and soon after, the rapid withdrawal of Marines to their ships. Sound familiar? The recent outburst of anti-American anger sweeping much of the Arab world today may have come on suddenly, but the underlying outrage is fed by decades of resentment against the U.S. and its dearest ally, Israel. Few events have fueled that anger more than the massacre of, let's say, well over 1,000 Palestinian refugees in Beirut on September 16, 1982. So the question remains, just how long will we insist on repeating history before we finally learn from it? And in the interim, just how many innocent Arab women and children will have to pay the price for our willful neglect of the obvious.
Spitfire breathes the lives of women of color in Montreal.
We are here to speak our truth and to say no to the silencing of our voices in a racist and sexist society.
Spoken word. Interview.
What's that? Hot.
Spitfire breathes the lives of women of color in Montreal.
Tune in to Spitfire every last Wednesday of the month from 6 to 7 p.m. on 90.3 FM CKUT Radio.
That's right. You are listening to Spitfire Radio on CKUT 90.3 FM. For those of you just tuning in, my name is Alyssa. It is just almost after quarter two. That didn't make sense. It is just after 6:45. We turn now to the U.S. presidential elections. So if all the votes are actually counted, the first black president, it appears to aggregates of the polls, will be reelected. Mr. Obama received the all-important post-convention bump, which is common for both Republican and Democratic parties who hold their conventions during the last week of August and first week of September. one of the highlights of the Democratic National Convention that has been touted universally by so-called progressive, liberal, or what could be construed as left-of-center media, was the 40-plus minute speech by former President Bill Clinton. Clinton went in on Republican misrepresentations of Obama's record and pointed to his own record as an 8-year president to show us all where the United States needs to go. I watched some portions of the speech, but found myself unable to stomach the entire thing by one of the most popular former presidents to date. I found myself becoming nauseous and stressed out, and then it hit me as to why. Bill Clinton is one of the sleaziest, sexually predatory, and in some cases, as the past has shown, alleged rapist who has used his positions of power in government to sexually assault women, harass women, and then use taxpayer resources to cover up his inability to not take advantage of his power. Below the fray of the famous scandal toward the end of his presidency, I'm speaking of the Monica Lewinsky affair, is an entire vault of previous allegations of sexual misconduct, harassment, and impropriety. Most of the women making allegations against the former president were acquainted with Clinton in a professional capacity. Take the famous case of Paula Jones, a former Arkansas state employee whose allegations of sexual harassment led to an almost $1 million settlement towards the end of his second term. Or take the experience of Juanita Broadwick. This is a more grotesque example. She was a former nursing home supervisor in the 1970s in Arkansas, who allegedly was sexually assaulted by Bill Clinton while he was state attorney in 1978. I could go on, but in the interest of time, it might be sufficient to say that he has a long-standing reputation of exploiting his power to prey upon women in subordinate positions. To me, watching what made this appearance at the Democratic National Convention circa 2012 more disgusting or more saddening was the fact that he was introduced by an inspiring young woman, Sandra Fluke, a Georgetown law student who received national attention earlier this year after her activism around women's reproductive rights, which are right now under assault across state legislatures. She was the target of right-wing talk show radio host Rush Limbaugh's vitriol. Limbaugh referred to Fluke as a slut and a prostitute on his show, suggesting that Ms. Fluke should have to perform sex in front of the camera for him to watch. Is the presence of Bill Clinton after this courageous young woman the right message to send to women who are daily subjected to sexual harassment from men in positions of power and who are often unable to access the needed remedies to stop this abuse, i.e. sexual harassment legislation is a joke? What kind of double standard is this for political leaders or for men seeking public office when it was only last fall when, after a spate of sexual harassing allegations, Herman Cain, the Republican candidate for president, was forced to resign from running for the nomination? What is so special about Bill Clinton, I should note a white man, and so disqualifying about Herman Cain, an actual black man, not just a metaphorical black man, as Bill Clinton has been described as the first black president, for essentially allegedly committing the same forms of harassment? And sidebar, I'm not suggesting Cain should not have been forced out of the race. He clearly should have. That's embarrassing. During the 1998 impeachment process, the famous Toni Morrison wrote of Bill Clinton, "It appears that white skin notwithstanding, this is our first black president, blacker than any black person who could ever be elected in our children's lifetime. After all, Clinton displays almost every trope of blackness, single parent household, born poor, working class, saxophone playing, McDonald's and junk food loving boy from Arkansas." That's a quote from her. "With all due respect to perhaps the greatest writer of our generation, I find it appalling to associate Bill Clinton's immorality and difficult family childhood with blackness. The implication of Clinton as the first U.S. black president, and this is pre-Barack Obama, means that there is also something authentically black about being a repeated sexual predator, about having an uncontrollable sexuality, an appetite that cannot be controlled, which is a horrible stereotype perpetrated against black folks generations over. We need to revisit the Clinton administration and its impact on people of color, especially poor black and Latino women. His infamous welfare reform bill, introduced midway through his presidency, led to millions of low-income women with children being thrown off welfare rolls and told to go into low-wage jobs without the provision of daycare. Analysts have traced this to the rise of childhood hunger and poverty in the U.S. and the growth of racial disparities in both income and wealth. Clinton is also responsible for passing much of financial financial deregulation that led to the housing bubble and subsequent financial crisis, coincidentally hitting Blacks and Latinos in the U.S. especially hard. He was also a huge believer in free trade, you know, that neoliberal process by which high wage or at least well-paying jobs in the U.S. and Canada are outsourced abroad to save costs for businesses and evil corporations. These policies, as an aggregate, reveal the farce of Bill Clinton, neither a great president nor a president for a great president for Black people specifically. Bill Clinton helped cement the Republican Revolution, as it was then called, which has helped entrench the tenets of extreme free market fundamentalism cherished by what we could call the Republican base. Clinton may have the charisma that no other living president have. He may have an impressive spouse and daughter, though one wonders what they really think of him. He may still be beloved by a so-called left in the U.S. who fail to see their own hypocrisy on his blatant misogyny and history of sexual violation, a hindrance to any efforts to come close to this thing we call gender equality. Let us not pretend that he is not what all the facts point to, a sleazy, power-hungry, ego-obsessed, Southern and white male politician who has no problem sexually exploiting women, then throwing them under the bus when it becomes politically expedient to do so. Much has been written about the obvious dislike Bill Clinton and the current President Barack Obama have for one another. Such disdain was obvious in the presidential race in 08 as Clinton campaigned for his opponent, his own wife, in the primaries. I'm not too fond of Barack Obama, but the fact that he obviously doesn't like Bill Clinton makes me like Barack Obama a lot more.
Be the answer. I'm ready to dance when the vamp up. Then when I hit that dip, get your camera. You can see even that bitch shit the pamper. In the DM that young sister beacon. The bitch who wants to compete. And I can freak fit that pump with the peep. And you know what your bitch become when her weep. And I just wanna sip that punch with your peeps. And sit in that lunch if you're treating. Kick it with your bitch who come from Parisian. She know where to get mine from in the season. Now she wanna lick my plum in the evening. And flip that tongue to deepen. I guess that cunt get any in. I guess that cunt get any in. I guess that can't get any in. I guess that can't get any in. I was in the 212 on the uptown, hey nigga, you know what's up or don't you? Worker who made ya? I'm a rude bitch, nigga, what are you made up of? I'ma eat your food up, boo, I could bust your eight. I'm a 212, fuck a gun do. When you do make bucks, I'ma look right, nigga, bet you do want to fuck. Fuck them like you do want to come. You gated, get discovered, I'm a 212 dude's cock. A lickin' in the water by the blue bayou. Caught the warm goose, and you do rag too, son. Nigga, you're a Kool-Aid dude, plus your bitch might lick it. Wonder who let you come to 12. What you do to crew, son? Fuck are you into, huh? Niggas better ooh run run. You could get shot, homie, if you want to. Put your guns up, tell your crew don't front. I'm a hoodlum, nigga, you know you were two ones. Bitch, I'm about to blue up too. I'm the 12 day, I'm the new Shifu, young Rapunzel. Who are you, bitch, new lunch? I'ma ruin you, cunt.
You are listening to Spitfire Women of Color Radio. Just got some awesome announcements and events. Starting off with Loretta Ross.
Don't forget to check out her speech this Thursday, September 27th at 7 p.m. Concordia University, 1455. It's going to be on race, rape culture, and reproductive justice.
Also at Concordia University, September 28th at 6:30 p.m., Defending the Land, Indigenous Women's Resistance to Plan Nord and Community Violence.
So this is with guest speakers Denise Jordan, Elise Vallant, and Alain Gabriel. So check that.
Go see Where the Blood Mixes, 8 p.m. tonight, tomorrow, Friday, Saturday, with a Sunday and Saturday matinee, 2 p.m., put on by the Tisserie Dunia Theater at Cultural Calixa La Valle. That's 3819 Parc La Fontaine.
And this coming Friday, and then by this coming Friday, I mean next Friday, at 12:30 to 2 p.m. at the Law School of McGill University, there will be a talk, Black Women in Public Life Representing Michelle Obama, by Joanne St. Louis, who is an amazing professor of law at the University of Ottawa. That's going to be happening in Chancellor Day Building, room 16 on the first floor of the law school. For more information, you can contact Professor Verinda Narain, verindanarain@gmail.com, but that's Friday, October 5th, 12:30 to 2, in room 16 at the law school. Check it out.
Z Justice International Film Festival is opening tomorrow night. That's Thursday, September 27th at 7 p.m. and going on to the 29th of September. This is a festival that is film, poetry, photography, and it's for the 24th anniversary of the massacre of political prisoners in Iran. Z Gallery is at 5445 De Gaspé. Building number 315. For more information, visit www.zgallery.ca.
That brings us to the end of another edition of Spitfire. Next month, it's our 10th anniversary! Woo! Woo! So stay tuned for a special edition of Spitfire next month. We have a very special occasion this month as well. We are a jam-packed studio tonight, and I would like to now make the opportunity for every one of our new Spitfire members to come on the mic and just introduce themselves and say whatever they want. If they're shy, I'm going to say their names anyways. Are you shy, Mercedes? So I'd like to introduce Mercedes. Check her out. She's going to be with us from now on out. Anybody else on the mic? Take it now.
We got Melissa on the mic on Spitfire.
Holla!
Ow! Hola, my name's Chris, and I'm super glad to be here.
And we're so glad to have you.
No? Okay, well, the other person saying no, her name is Yasmin, and I'm gonna tease her after the show. You'll be hearing from her next month first.
And a shout out to Miriam Zaidi, who's gonna be joining our collective next month. Woo! Super solid chick, super solid activist. She's not a chick, she's a fucking solid activist. I just dropped an F-bomb on the air. Children, close your ears.
Spitfire Women of Color Radio broadcasts every last Wednesday of the month at 6 p.m. on CKUT Radio 90.3 FM. You can write us at spitfire@ckut.ca and check out www.spitfire.blogspot.com. Peace!
People screaming hardcore, living in the ghetto, sleeping on the floor. What you thought I was gonna rise? Do my thing, get my piece of the pie. You're holding your breath for great God out the sky. Best live your life, cause you just waiting to die. People still taking life for a joke. Can't see the fire, but you blow out of smoke. If you didn't get it, you got what you deserve. Just like that, that's my word. Every day I wake up, seeming on the come up. No daydreaming, got to stay one up. How you gonna sit back and wait on the wealth? Gotta go get it, motivate yourself. If not, you only perpetrate yourself. And at the end of the day, you only hate yourself. If you know me, you know my motto. Take in charge. You got what it takes to make it. Make it all.